Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum is located at Whitefish Point in Michigan's Upper Peninsula in the southeast corner of Lake Superior. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Bruce Lynn, Executive Director of the Great Lakes Shipwreck Historical Society.
When the skies of November turn gloomy.
My name is Bruce Lynn. I'm the executive director of the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum. We're located at Whitefish Point in the eastern end of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and we're in the southeast corner of Lake Superior.
This region here, right off of Whitefish Point, is one of the deadliest, most treacherous places in the Great Lakes.
You know, if you look at it and break it down, it makes sense. But I think for most of our visitors that come to the museum, I think it's a real discovery for them. People will walk out on our deck, they'll look out over the lake. Often it's very smooth. A lot of times it's pretty dramatic. But, you know, more often than not for our visitors in the summer, and that's when we're open, they see a relatively calm lake. So it doesn't make as much sense. But I'll often tell people when people that come and visit us in October and they see 5-6 foot waves coming in off the point, it makes a lot more sense.
Hard to imagine today. It looks like a mild sea, but there's still white caps and waves. But to imagine that it can look as brutal as the Pacific Ocean is pretty amazing.
Absolutely. And if you watch the ocean and you watch the waves when they come in and you are visiting a great lake, especially like Lake Superior, and you see the way those waves roll in, it's a different kind of action. They're moving quicker. They're dropping quicker. It really made a big difference for a lot of the ships back in the day when we're looking in the 1800s and early 1900s.
I presume that the wavelength is typically shorter and more frequent waves, which can be more treacherous.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just a whole different action.
Right here, this is a very historic site and a destination, and it's more than just a Coast Guard station or a lighthouse. Tell us about the breadth of what is here and what was here in the day.
We're located on an historic light station at Whitefish Point. The first light station was here in the late 1840s. The lighthouse service, the federal government recognized with all the ship traffic that was starting at that point. You had discoveries of copper and iron ore in the western Upper Peninsula and Minnesota and those areas, western Lake Superior. And so there was a need that could be seen for the first navigational aid in Lake Superior. So they built this lighthouse in 1848, 1849. It wasn't going to last long. Within the first year, your lighthouse keepers were complaining that it was unsafe. Then before you know it, and we're approaching the Civil War at this point, late 1850s, they decided to build a new lighthouse here. Very unique tower, iron pile it's called, designed to withstand very strong winds and dramatic weather. But it was finished in 1861. Abraham Lincoln's administration, we're very proud of that fact, and it's still operating. Here we are in 2016, and this is still an operating navigational aid.
And at that time, it was, correct my pronunciation, a Fresnel lens?
A Fresnel lens.
A Fresnel lens.
Right. You know, it's interesting. People ask us about that all the time. And your first generation lighthouse that was here had what were called Lewis lamps. This is kind of lighthouse techie nerd stuff. But and none of us really, and I say none of us, that kind of historical community, it doesn't seem like many people are aware of any of these lamps, these Lewis lamps existing at this point. But they had parabolic reflectors. They had little oil reservoirs with them. But you could have as many as 20 or more that your lighthouse keepers would have to maintain.
Wow. And what was the distance that you could see the illumination?
You know, with the early ones, not as far.
5-7 miles?
Yeah, probably a little more than that. But when the Fresnel lens came along, this is 1822 technology. Now you had prisms surrounding a single light source. It was, to a degree, it was less work for the lighthouse keepers. But if you look at these Fresnel lenses and all those prisms and the brass and copper and everything else that's a part of it, they, being the lighthouse keepers, were required to polish and clean all that. They had to do all of it before 10 o'clock in the morning.
Every day.
Every day, that's right.
So the magnification of what the candle power or whatever was quite incredible.
It really was. There are even times where you read about these ships that were operating and they could be 40 miles away and they would say definitively, we can see that lighthouse 40 miles away. Obviously, there's other things happening there. But
you have one right above your head here, an original one. It looks like space age. It looks futuristic today.
I think it does. It's a work of art. This particular lens we have is from a lighthouse that was down on the Straits of Mackinac, so due south of us. This one was not original to Whitefish Point, but it's a second-order lens, largest size ever used on the Great Lakes. This is a bivalve that kind of looks like a big clamshell, but these things rotate, and they are just stunning to look at.
Today, that 1861 President Lincoln era lighthouse is still intact and still operational, although with an LED.
Correct. It is still an operating lighthouse. We'll have people that come through and ask the question, are these lighthouses really necessary at this point? So we've had that question for years, and I had the opportunity to speak with the captain of the largest ship operating in the Great Lakes. The ship is called the Paul Tregurtha, part of the Interlake Steamship Line, 1,014 feet long. I asked this captain, do you really need these lighthouses at this point? Because I said, we hear this all the time. And he kind of paused for a moment, and he gave me an answer. I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was to the effect that, you know, certainly with all the technology they have today, they may not necessarily need them, but there's something to be said about looking at them with your own eyes. Technology can fail, but if this lighthouse is operating, we can see it 10 or 12 or whatever miles away and know where we are.
Definitely a reality check. You can be looking at your radar and see where it is, you know, on the scope, then to visually look out of the wheelhouse and, yeah, it is. I've been there.
I think that's what he was saying. Absolutely.
Right here, right near here, within, 20 miles, was one of the greatest tragedies on the Great Lakes. Tell us about that story.
The Edmund Fitzgerald, 729-foot ore carrier, was the flagship of one of the larger steamship lines on the Great Lakes. And Gordon Lightfoot obviously had written a song after it sank about this vessel. But 17 miles northwest of where we're located now at Whitefish Point, the Edmund Fitzgerald rests in a little over 500 feet of water, and it is in Canadian waters. So that proximity and the fact that the Edmund Fitzgerald, which is still a mystery today, we don't really know why it sank, but the fact that it was making its way to Whitefish Bay and hopefully to get in out of that weather and find a safe harbor, so to speak, the fact that it didn't make it, it was that close.
The rapidity of its demise has probably pushed it to that, you know, unbelievable level.
I think so, yeah. It's still a mystery. There have been so many expeditions, including Jacques Cousteau coming into the Great Lakes, and they dove on the Fitzgerald with their submarine. It's kind of gotten into the public consciousness, and particularly on the Great Lakes.
Let's talk about the postscript of the song, the Edmund Fitzgerald, and how that really, in so many ways, propelled the myth, legend, and lore of the Edmund Fitzgerald into the psyche of America forever.
You know, I think that's probably true. Gordon Lightfoot did an excellent job. He pretty much was historically accurate when he told that story through the song. That song was number 2 in 1976 on the Billboard chart. He comes back to the Shipwreck Museum not infrequently. He was here last November the 9th and met with some of the surviving family members. For me, in my position, it was interesting to watch that interaction, because here you had the man who wrote the song that really made the ship famous, and here you had those family members who, by that ship being made famous, it's been in the public eye all this time. But it was a very cordial and very kind of heartwarming interaction.
Did you ever ask him for the backstory of how he came to be interested in to write that song?
You know, I have not, but
next time you have to do that.
Absolutely. I will say one of our board members, though, had a discussion with him at one point about that. And it seems to me that he was coming back from the West Coast, and there was a blurb in I believe it was Newsweek magazine, and he'd read this. They misspelled the name Edmund Fitzgerald. Now, Gordon Lightfoot grew up in the area of the Great Lakes, and he knew how important this ship was and knew how much of a tragedy this really was. And to my understanding, he told that story through the song to kind of bring a greater awareness and get the story right, do it justice.
To honor those who were on board in the vessel.
Certainly, absolutely.
If he had not done that, if that song had not become a hit, people wouldn't know about that vessel any more than the other shipwrecks, right?
It's a very good question. There are a lot of shipwrecks of, maybe not quite as long, but there's two shipwrecks that we have represented here in the gallery. One is the Daniel J. Morrell. It sank in northern Lake Huron in 1966. There was only one survivor. The other is 1958, Carl D. Bradley. There were two survivors. Very dramatic stories.
And these are out of crews of 30-man crews on average?
Approximately, yes, approximately that many. Big crews, a lot of men, and they disappeared. In each case, it was the last trip of the season. The Carl D. Bradley and that crew, they had Thanksgiving on their minds. They were headed home, headed back to Rogers City, Michigan, and those are wonderful stories. But, and not that no one has ever written songs about them, but they didn't make number 2 on the Billboard chart, and they didn't sort of take on that kind of almost public consciousness at the same time.
There's a local myth or legend about one of the ships that went down, and I think only one guy survived, And the kids in the town called him the man who never smiled.
Oh, yes.
What is that?
That's an interesting story. This gentleman, and it was the Independence, was a ship that actually had a boiler explosion in the St. Mary's River, not very far. And we actually have part of the hull of the ship here inside of the museum, part of the keel. What ended up happening was when this gentleman was blown from the ship, literally, he suffered some facial damage. There were a few survivors from that shipwreck, but in the end, because of that, and this was from an old newspaper report from the era, but from that nerve damage, I believe it was, to his face, he probably had this kind of permanent scowl, but who knows, maybe some kind of legendary and maybe superstitious significance probably came along with that at the same time, because people knew he was a survivor from that wreck.
Tell us about the other dimensions of this right here. You have a Coast Guard station, naval station, all historic sites. Talk to us about that. And it looks like an antique foghorn out there.
Yes, we're kind of up here. We feel like we're in the middle of nowhere. We kind of joke about that a little bit, but we're very far away from what a lot of people call civilization. But at this little tip of land, there was a light station as of the 1840s, so again, U.S. government at that point. By the 1920s, things started to happen around here. The United States Coast Guard constructed a rescue station, much like some people would have seen on that movie, The Finest Hours, that came out recently. The U.S. Navy ended up having a radio compass station here. So all of this surrounding the idea of either preventing shipwrecks or, if something happened, to try to rescue people, survivors, whatnot, from shipwrecks. And we interpret all that history here.
The compass station, kind of clarify, was that for boxing compasses, or what was the function of that?
You know what it was? I believe, and I'm trying to remember how all this worked, you had a couple different aspects that were working into this, but how they used to use the radios, when that first started to become something that was used on the Great Lakes, or really, I think shortly after the Titanic sank, they started making this more important, and I think they were working with these radio compasses to help these ships navigate through the area and better understand where they were. There were other kinds of technology that came into that. There was other technologies that were completely separate that most people never heard of that were experimented with or used up here too, including something called a submarine bell, which was an underwater bell that had a cable going out to it. If I remember correctly, it was an electronic impulse that would activate this bell. The ships, some of them, had sensors in their hulls that could pick up this sound, and it almost acted like a fog signal, so they could hear it. Think of how sound travels underwater. So that was a different kind of technology. So you had different things that were being tried out, and I think with all the traffic that was passing us at Whitefish Point, it probably seemed like a logical place to try these things.
Bruce Lynn, we're out of time. Thank you so much for sharing. This has been a wonderful day for me.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for joining us here at Whitefish Point in the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum. Shipwreckmuseum.com. That's our website, and you'll find out all kinds of things about what we are and what we do and how to get here.
Chris Lynn, thanks again.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Michigan.
The sinking of the ore carrier SS Edmund Fitzgerald in November 1975 occurred just 17 miles from the Whitefish Point Lighthouse, and it spurred Gordon Lightfoot to pen the hit song The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The song quickly became a number one hit in Lightfoot's native Canada, and before long a number two hit on the charts in America.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez, Melissa Corbin, Tennessee, Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkan Songs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
Could it be the north wind they've been feeling? The wind and the wires made a tattletale sound, and the wave broke over the railing. And every man knew, as the captain did too, 'twas the witch of November come stealing. The dawn came late. gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain. In the face of a hurricane west wind, saying, fellas, it's too rough to feed you. At 7 p.m. a main hatchway gave in. He said, fellas, it's been good to know you. The captain wired in, he had water coming in, and the good ship and crew was in peril. And later that night, when his lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours? The searchers all say they'd have made Whitefish Bay if they'd put 15 more miles behind her. They might have split up or they might have capsized. They may have broke deep and took water. And all that remains is the faces and the names of the wives and the sons and the daughters. Lake Huron rolls, Superior sings in the rooms of her ice water mansion. Old Michigan steams like a young man's dreams. The islands and bays are for sportsmen. And farther below, Lake Ontario takes in what Lake Erie can send her. The iron boats go as the mariners all know. The gales of November remembered. Musty old hall in Detroit, they prayed in the Maritime Sailors' Cathedral. The church bell chimed till it rang 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Superior, they said, never gives up her dead when the gales of November come early.